welcome to the seventh episode of the Allegra Escorts podcast. We did decide on the name episode as opposed to installment, much to Miss Evangeline Baudin's chagrin, and she is joining us today. How are you, Evangeline?
I'm fantastic. How are you?
I'm good. And our guest for today is Azura Rose. How are you, Azura?
I'm doing really well today, thanks.
Good. Well, thanks for joining us today, and thanks for joining us for our what seems to be a pretty frequently repeated format, which is the five questions for every provider. I've heard some good feedback about this, so we're going to continue using this format for a little while until we get bored and decide to do something else. So why don't we just jump straight into it, and I'll ask you the first question, which is, what is the nicest thing that a client's ever done for you?
The nicest thing a client ever did. I mean, it's hard to say because a lot of my clients do really nice things, but I think the one where they went above and beyond. I have one client of mine I really like. He came to see me give a talk on disability at a feminist conference. Mm-hmm. And he stayed for the whole thing, asked some questions. It was really nice of him to show up for that.
That's great.
That's very supportive.
Yeah, it was wonderful, and it was nice to see like a client engaging in feminism and talking about disability, and actually like engaging in the sort of things I talk about all the time. So it was nice for him to like take an interest.
Well, that's really great. I mean, a lot of clients, the stereotype certainly is that they are only interested in one thing as opposed to many things, and it's great when you find out that a client is interested in your other activities as well.
Yeah, totally. It's nice when they, like, it's nice for them to see you as a full, well-rounded person and for them to also, like, express their own interests and see each other as people, not just as a one-hour sort of bland 2D sort of cutout of each other, that we actually engage and learn about each other a bit more deeply.
Amazing. So which conference was it that he came to?
It was the Playground Conference. It's like a feminism and sexuality conference that used to be annual. It's not running as regularly anymore, though there's been smaller incarnations of it recently. Like the Smut in the Six conference, which this client also went to.
Really?
Yeah.
So it sounds like he's been present for a lot of your public activism and a lot of the work that you do surrounding educating the rest of society.
Yeah, and even stuff I haven't been at, like the Smut in the Six, there were talks before I showed up, and he was at those as well. I believe one of our other providers, Billy, was there and was giving a talk, and he was there for that as well.
Oh, okay, cool. So when you talk about disability and sexuality, how do you find that intersects with your work other than just educating clients who happen to come to the conferences you speak at?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of letting them know, like, what I can and can't do. A lot of it also involves telling them, like, I totally can do some things that they might assume that I can't. A lot of breaking stereotypes that disabled people are not interested in sex or incapable of having sex. Like, disabled people totally have sexualities of our own. And it also involves speaking to sort of how to adjust with, like, worsening disability or new disability to like how to still have fun with your body and how to still love your body when it's not functioning the way you necessarily want it to.
Well, that's really like the way you put that.
Yeah, and I think that's something that all human beings can relate to, right?
Definitely.
Totally, and it's just something that sort of sticks out in your mind more when you suddenly like have to walk on a cane. It's like, how do you adjust to stuff when your legs don't work properly? How do you adjust to feeling confident in the bedroom when you don't necessarily feel confident walking down the street?
Okay, well, thank you. I thought that was a really good answer to the first question, so let's go on to the second. What's the funniest thing that's ever happened to you in this business? And I can see you smiling as I ask the question.
I sort of like peruse the questions ahead of time, and there's one sort of thing that kind of stuck out to me and happened in a call, actually. There's one client I had, we were talking about gothic music and gothic fashion and vampires, especially because I post a lot of selfies online where I have vampire fangs and stuff. So we were talking about that, and then we went into the call, and there was a little bit of oral. And then my period started a bit early. And I checked with him to make sure it was okay, and he seemed fine with it. I'm like, well, we were talking about vampires, so I guess I kind of jinxed myself.
I guess so.
Yeah, we both laughed pretty hard at that.
Well, you know, instead of getting the blood out of your neck, he was able to get it out of somewhere a little bit more convenient, perhaps?
Well, you know what they say about lesbian vampires.
No, what do they say?
Well, they sure like oral.
Okay, I should have probably guessed that based on the context, but I was not aware that that was something that happened in the vampire subculture of lesbians.
I don't imagine it's a very large community, but then...
Probably not. Although this is June and it's Pride Month in Toronto, so maybe they'll have a float at the parade?
I don't know. The parades are usually in the sun during the day, so I don't know.
They can't come.
Well, they can come. They just can't be in a parade.
Oh, we're full of the double entendres tonight. I love it. Awesome. Okay, well, let's go to the next question then, which is one thing that you wish everyone knew about the industry.
This was sort of a bit harder, but my favorite thing about the industry is the diversity. Mm-hmm. And I wish people kind of understood that better, especially people who are from outside the industry. They usually, the portrayals on the media are not the greatest, but within the industry, like, everyone I know is, there's so much variation and everyone has their own place. Mm-hmm. Like, there are people with different genders, different races, people like me who are disabled are, like, well represented, and I think it's great that there's so much diversity and that there are a bunch of different bodies and different personality types, and that there's kind of like a space for everyone, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's really nice to see that people can look at something and know that they want it and then create a space for themselves, and anybody can do that so long as they're interested.
Exactly, and the barrier to entry for this industry is pretty low compared to a lot of others, so it's one where you see like a lot of really colorful personalities and a lot of very different people, which mm-hmm. it's great to go to parties and just yeah. see like all the like people watching at a party is like the best in this industry.
Definitely. I think that a lot of the conversation around diversity focuses on the diversity of providers, and that's one thing that a lot of people don't necessarily realize exists, because the stereotypes and the barrier to entry, I would suggest, is actually the stigma. That is probably the single biggest barrier to entering the sex trade and then having success in it because of that.
Yeah, I definitely agree there that there's a lot of stigma and that can be a big barrier. Like, the only reason I started as late as I did is because of stigma and not realizing it was such a good fit for me. Mm-hmm. But then once you get in, there's so many different areas that you can go into, like from fetish to GFE to PSE and all the different stuff that you can offer. There are some people who focus on going out shopping, going on dinner dates, or people who focus more in like intimate personal encounters or discussions or being more political. And I like that there's so many different options. We're not all expected to be cookie cutter, exactly the same copies of each other. And I like that there's room for individuality and expression in the industry.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say that you found that it was a good fit for you. What was it about the industry that you found fit you really well?
Well, first,
no pun intended, of course.
Well, one of the first things is that, unlike a lot of other jobs I've had, no one told me that I had to take my eyebrow piercing out. No one told me I couldn't have visible tattoos. So that was really helpful off the bat. And there's a lot of employment discrimination for people who are disabled. And even just an inability to do a lot of jobs because of my own physical limitations. But I've always been able to have sex. It's never been a problem for me. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It's been a good fit for that, and then also being able to set my own hours, and then if I need to have a doctor's appointment, I don't have to book time off. I just schedule myself around it. I can work before or after, mm-hmm. and I don't have to miss out on a day's work because I have a doctor's appointment. And also, I can make enough on my good days that when I have a bad day, I can just take the time off, and it's not like a regular job where you only get 10 sick days a year, and then you're out of luck. I get sick more than 10 days a year, I can tell you that. Mm-hmm. So it's a really good fit for that reason as well.
Interesting. Well, a lot of the same reasons that you mentioned also fit with students who do the work, right? Because they don't have the same flexibility in their schedule. And, you know, some days you have class, some days you don't. So you work on the days that you don't. Some days you have exams. Some weeks you have exams. You take that week off so you can study. And then after it's done, you can work. And I think that the flexibility that it provides is definitely valuable to a lot of people in a lot of situations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The only other jobs I found that had similar flexibility were really terrible minimum wage jobs. And you can't really survive on that.
Mm-hmm.
So the industry has been much better as a career option than anything else I've ever done.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing to hear that when you think about how the stereotype talks about it being the last option for so many people, when it sounds like it's just simply the best option for you.
Oh yeah, it totally was. I mean, I started because I was unemployed and looking for work. I mean, you don't usually switch jobs when you have a good job, but
that's true. That's why I haven't switched out of this job.
Exactly.
I found a better one in 8 years.
And that's why I'm still here after over a year.
Mm-hmm.
But I had been looking for work, and I'd been in the kink community for a long time. And I figured, well, I've spent so much money on toys and lessons and workshops, I might as well make money off of my hobby. And that gradually brought me further into the industry, where I'm like, oh, well, you know, I want to do this also. I want to provide this as well. And I just kind of expanding what I was doing, and I really enjoyed what I was doing. So I'm like, well, why stop just because I've had other job offers? Like, I just enjoy this more. Mm-hmm. So it fits really well.
So you mentioned the fact that you're active in the kink community as well. And how have you found that that helps you market yourself? Like, do you find that you're a little bit more niche oriented because of those experiences, or?
I find I'm more niche in that not everyone wants like a pro submissive. There's mm-hmm. a lot more of a market for DOMs or for regular vanilla providers. But because I'm one of few, that I get a lot of repeats, and also that it really helps me even when I do have less kinky clients, that I've had experience negotiating with new people very quickly for performances. And in the kink community, we often have like in-depth negotiations, so I've had a lot of experience like getting to know people's boundaries really quickly, and it's come in a lot of handy just trying to work that out with people when you've just met them.
Certainly, I can imagine that communication would be critical in any situation, let alone transactional, let alone kink related, let alone submissive. I mean, if you're putting yourself in a position where someone is going to be dominating you, you certainly want to be able to set the limits beforehand.
Yeah, and it's given me a good ability to figure out what level of trust I'm comfortable with people before I do stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, knowing where my comfort levels are and being able to read people really well comes from, like, I have, I think at this point, 7 years I've been in the local kink community. So that's a lot of experience to bring into a new job,
mm-hmm.
7 years. So it came in handy to be able to read people and kind of get a sense of what my body can handle and what my body can't, and kind of getting a sense of what feels good, what does not feel good, and learning what feels good for a lot of other people, and being able to be a bit more flexible. Not really pun intended,
again. All right, well, let's move on to the fourth question then, which is, what is one thing you wish you knew when you first started?
The one thing I wish I knew when I started? Probably about the wonderful sex workers' rights community.
Hmm.
It was kind of a rough start for me in the industry. I worked one dungeon that was awesome, and then the second place I worked was really exploitative and ableist and transphobic and awful. And I hated it there. And it would have been really great to have the support of other sex workers that respect my body and my choices and my disability and everyone's gender issues. I mean, I have that now, which is awesome. And especially with the collective, that we all support each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just something I wish I'd had when I'd started, rather than kind of working stuff out on my own and not really being aware of other sex workers. Which sounds a bit strange, but like, I didn't realize that there was a group of people who were so engaged in supporting each other, and that were really supportive of making sure that everyone who worked was working because they wanted to and was working in conditions that were, you know, proper working conditions. And I wish I had that when I was first starting out. And I try and do my best now through Allegra and being in now in the sex worker community online, trying to provide that support for as many people as we can.
Mm-hmm. Well, the isolation is certainly problematic for a lot of people. And you don't necessarily know what supports exist when you first come into it because of that stigma and because it's so marginalized in a lot of ways. And workers ourselves are very marginalized in a lot of cases. Some of us are quite privileged, but even still, the most privileged of sex workers is nowhere near as privileged as, you know, a 9-to-5 white-collar worker by any stretch, you know?
Yeah, and some of the issue is also that we're not... For a while, like when I first started working, it was before the Bedford case, so we weren't really allowed to communicate very much, which makes it very hard to reach out and find support when your work is criminalized. It's very hard to, you can't just go to the labor board and be like, oh, well, my manager is being super discriminatory and expecting me to work for free. Like, you can do that in a normal job, but when you're criminalized, you can't advocate for your rights the same way. Mm-hmm. And you can't get in touch with people to support you in advocating for those rights when you're criminalized and they can't communicate with you, or at least can't communicate openly enough for a newbie to be able to find them.
I think that's why a lot of us are drawn to the collective here, because we all know what that feels like to not have support, to not know that support is available. And as good as it feels now to have that, it's also really... exciting, and it just feels really good to be able to give that to other people, especially people who are new or people who don't have a lot of experience or who come from what are very unpleasant situations, to be able to change work and life for them by being kind. It's a really wonderful thing.
I agree, and one of the things that I found, I shouldn't have found it surprising, I don't think that's the right word for it, but like I said, I've had a fairly privileged experience so far, and having been involved in the sex workers' rights movement for quite some time, I have a strong community supporting me already. And when I heard some of the stories from other people who had joined the collective in recent months, when we were sitting down and talking during, you know, a barbecue or a party or a trip to the beach or wherever it is we go, hearing some of the horrible stories of exploitation that they had gone through, I was certainly aware that those things existed, but I was unaware of how many people just assumed that that was the status quo and assumed that that was the way that things were supposed to be because they hadn't heard of anything better or weren't even aware of any alternatives that existed.
Well, anytime that you're isolated and bad things happen, you have nobody to talk to with to help offer context to it, mm-hmm. to know that that is not how it should be and that there are other options.
And it really doesn't help that a lot of the media representation is of that exploited, marginalized person, like even from people who are right-wing or left-wing, seeing us as people who are inherently exploited, inherently being abused, seeing all managers as quote-unquote pimps. So then you just expect that that's normal treatment. Mm-hmm. You don't think, oh, well, there's something better out there for me. There's a better option, because anytime someone speaks out and says, oh, well, my experience with sex work is better and yours can be better too, they just get swarmed on Twitter with people being like, you're not representational.
No kidding.
You are too privileged because you have access to Twitter. I'm like, literally everyone has access to Twitter. Yeah. I have a flip phone and I have access to Twitter. I mean, come on.
You know what? It's really unfortunate that it looks that way, because when the rescue industry is speaking about how terrible things are as a way to, you know, get more money, because they're basically just an industry trying to make money to pay for their jobs, they're essentially telling sex workers to internalize that stigma and that abuse and recreating those very harms that they claim to be fighting against, when they know full well that there are people who don't experience that, and they try and silence those who don't experience that nastiness and that abuse to push the narrative as if it was normal, that everybody experienced that, and then those who are experiencing it assume that it's normal. So an interesting recursive loop that seems to be happening there.
And it's even worse because you'll have people like me who were exploited and were treated very badly and experienced that abuse that come forward and say, no, criminalization doesn't help me. I want rights, and disagree with their perspective. Mm-hmm. And they're like, when I tell them that I want rights, they're like, you're not representational. I'm like, but essentially, based on the legal definition, I was a trafficking victim. You say you listen to survivors. I'm a survivor. I'm telling you that I want rights. And then they never answer you. Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, well, you're privileged. I'm like, I'm a queer disabled person. I am not that privileged. Mm-hmm. I am not the most privileged person out there. There are a lot of statistics on how disabled women are treated in Canada, and none of them are that, they're not happy statistics.
Definitely not.
I'm not a super privileged person. I do have some privilege, but to say like my advocating for my rights comes from a place of privilege when you're talking to a marginalized group, just, it's just the most confusing thing. Like no one thinks it makes sense when men say to women, oh, well, you're privileged, so why talk about sexism? That sounds stupid to anyone who's even remotely progressive, but say that to a sex worker and suddenly you are the like liberal bastion of like altruism. It's like, no, we want rights like every other marginalized group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And only rights can stop the wrongs, as the slogan goes. So.
I like that.
I do too. I wish more people did. But I think we're working on that as we speak, literally. This has been quite a lot of puns and double entendres today. I like it.
Exactly. And a lot of politics, which happens basically anytime I talk.
It happens when sex workers who have been around for a little while talk. I would like to hope it happens more often, and I would like to hope that these types of conversations make their way into the public discourse. But unfortunately, as you've mentioned, a lot of times it's obstructed or screened through those same prohibitionist voices that want to silence us, and sometimes they're able to, but not right now. That's what matters most. Okay, so let's move on to the fifth question, which is one piece of sex advice that you would like to share with our listeners.
I think we sort of touched on this a little bit earlier, but the one thing that's been key for me for everything that I've ever done in my sex life has been communication. Mm-hmm. So like in the kink community, making sure that you discuss, I mean, there's so many extra risks doing kink between, you know, you're using restraints or you're hitting someone or you're playing with their emotions or their psychology, and you have to sort of negotiate what you're okay with and what you're not. And while like you don't necessarily have to be super formal about it, it's also really important to discuss what you're into, what turns you on, what your limits are, what makes you get turned off, and making sure that both people are sort of on board.
I'm so glad that you said that. I think that communication is so important. Too often I feel like I hear people say that they don't have time to communicate, or it's not sexy to communicate. That's the only way to make sure that things are going to be good and healthy and positive and happy for everybody involved. If you don't talk, you have no idea what to do.
Not to mention, you can just turn dirty talk
yes.
into establishing consent.
Yes.
Like, I'm really, really, really bad at dirty talk. Like, just out of the blue, I'm really kind of awkward. And I'm also really bad at reading really subtle body language. Like, I want to know if that moan's a good moan or a bad moan, which is also really difficult to tell when you're flogging someone or doing something where pain and pleasure start to mix a little bit. Or if you're giving someone like a really rough massage, it's like, okay, I'm working that knot out, but you sound like you're in pain. I want to check in. And just saying like, oh, do you like that? Like, you can check in on their consent and not
yes.
break the mood. And
absolutely.
You can be like, oh, I really want to do this to you. Is that something you're into? You can turn all that into dirty talk mm-hmm. and make it part of the scene and part of your fun. It doesn't have to be this strange break where you're like, okay, well, I'm going to sit down and have a board meeting and write out a huge contract about what we do and do not do. Mm-hmm. But you can sort of like...
sign here, initial here.
Yeah, you don't need all that to have like...
So that could be fun if that's what you're into.
Totally. It totally can be. But even if you're signing a contract...
I can imagine a lawyer being into
that. Yes. But even signing a contract, you can throw in some dirty talk to make it more fun.
Yes.
Very true. And one of the things that makes me good at dirty talk is the fact that I'm always talking to people and saying, oh, do you like when I do this to that? Or do you want me to do a little bit of this to this? Or do you want me to try doing this or that? And it sounds sexy when you're asking it and the person is turned on by the thought of it and then by the act itself. But it's essentially just establishing consent prior to the action.
Mm-hmm.
I have noticed that almost everybody inevitably says that communication or consent or conversation end up being key to making something sexy. And most people's pieces of sex advice do fall under that category, but it's always within a different context. It's always with a different reason behind it. It's always a different explanation. So I think that that really shines a light on how important communication is, but how fundamentally different it is from person to person. And you want to find out what works for you and your partner to make sure that you're literally talking about the same thing and communicating the same way.
A really fun thing that is kind of something that I've learned from the kink community is asking people not do you like a certain thing, but why do you like a certain thing? So someone might like, they might say they like rope bondage, but why do they like it? Do they like the feeling of restraint? Do they like the texture? Do they like sort of being pushed and pulled by it? Like, what sort of emotion do they want to get out of this? Like, what sort of connection do they want? And that can, even if you're doing the exact same action, you can adjust how you're doing it. So there's the difference between enjoying a makeout because you like the animalistic passion of it. You'll make out very differently from someone who likes being very, like, romantic and soft. People can explain what they like in different ways, and you can make that communication really sexy. And it also means that both people come out of the situation having actually enjoyed themselves as much as they could, which is, I think, kind of the goal.
Yeah, it is, definitely. And it makes it recursive and dynamic, and it's always building on itself. And whatever the person says when you say, well, what do you like about XYZ, you can take that even further once you find out exactly what it is that they like. And then you can kind of guess whether or not they might like something else. And then you ask them if they like that, and they say yes or no. And it just keeps building on it and turns into a very sexy scene, no doubt.
Yes, and it also helps with, like, exploring new stuff, which can always be really fun to throw in something new. Whether you're in just a different mood today and you want to try kissing a different way, or if you want to try something kinky for the first time, just saying, like, hey, I've been thinking about this thing, are you into that? Just throwing in something new and communicating about it. And if you already have that dialogue established, it's easier to bring up something new and be like, hey, I was thinking about this. And trying something new when you've already been communicating about everything you like to start with, that it's not just out of the blue being like, so we never talk about sex, but I want to try wax play. It's like, that's kind of a weird way to start a conversation. But being like, hey, so you know that thing you did the other day, I want to try that, but maybe we could add this too. It sounds a lot more natural to when you're already talking about these things to start with.
Definitely, and that's one reason communication is so critical. Great. You know what? This was a really good podcast. Thank you for joining us, Asura. I'm really glad that you were able to be here with us today. And that was a lot of really good information.
You did a really good job.
Thanks for having me.
And so thank you again for joining us. And to our listeners, thanks for tuning in. I'm sorry that it's been so long since our last episode, but we're going to make sure that the next one comes pretty quickly as well. So make sure you don't come too quickly in the meantime. Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye-bye.